Tiesel Park finally came into view.
"Bloody hell," Carlton said, impressed by the scene before him.
The great house was ablaze in lights. The front driveway resembled a parking lot lined with fancy cars, many with diplomatic plates. Uniformed Gurkhas and policemen were stationed everywhere, trying to manage the traffic flow. As the three of them got out of the car, a large black military helicopter swooped into sight over the house and descended gracefully onto the manicured lawn. The doors slid open, and a portly Chinese man in his early 80s, dressed in a black suit with a deep purple tie, was the first to get out. A woman in a black cocktail dress with Art Deco patterned jet beading followed behind him. Rachel turned to Peck Lin.
"Is that the President and First Lady?"
"No, I have no idea who they are." Then a middle-aged man in a black suit emerged, and Carlton exclaimed,
"Well, that's the President of China!"
Peck Lin looked awestruck.
"Oh my God, Rachel! The President of China has come to pay his respects!"
Much to their surprise, the next person to emerge was a tall, lanky, college-aged kid with long, messy, shoulder-length brown hair, dressed in tight black jeans, steel-tipped black boots, and a black tuxedo jacket. A Chinese man in a pinstripe suit and a blonde middle-aged lady in a black dress with a pale green shawl draped around her shoulders emerged next, followed by a cute fair-haired girl of about 12.
"Stranger and stranger," Peck Lin said.
A small crowd had clustered outside the house to observe the arriving dignitaries, and as Rachel walked up, she saw Nick's cousin Alistair waving at her. Alistair greeted Rachel with a big bear hug before excitedly hugging Carlton and Peck Lin as well.
"Peck Lin, I haven't seen you since Rachel's wedding. I love your new red hair. I'm so glad you guys are finally here. It's been so lame inside. All anyone wants to talk about is who's getting the house. And now things are about to get even stuffier," he said, gesturing to the arriving VIPs.
"Who are those people with the President of China?" Rachel asked. Alistair looked momentarily surprised.
"Oh, you haven't met them yet?"
"Those people are the Imperial Shangs. The old farts are my Uncle Alfred and Auntie Mabel. The younger farts are my cousin Leonard and his very posh wife India, who's apparently descended from Mary, Queen of Scots, or something like that. And those are his kids, Casimir and Lucia. Doesn't Cass look like Harry Styles from One Direction?"
Everyone laughed.
"I think Harry's shorter," Peck Lin quipped.
"So they all just came from China?" Rachel asked, still confused.
"No, the Shangs just had dinner with the President at the Chinese embassy. The President's only here because of Uncle Alfred. He never knew Ama, of course."
"I believe my father knows him," Rachel remarked.
"They've been good friends since their university days, and Dad serves on his standing committee,"
Carlton chimed in.
"Of course. I keep forgetting your father is Bao Gaoliang," Alistair said.
"One last question. Who is that girl?" Carlton asked.
Stepping out last from the helicopter was an astonishingly Eurasian beauty in her early 20s. She had waist-length, sun-streaked hair, and wore a long, sleeveless black linen Rochas dress and gold sandals from Da Costanzo, looking like she had just stepped in from a beach party on Mallorca.
"I think I've just met my future wife,"
Carlton declared, as he watched the girl's hair billow around her sensationally under the draft of the helicopter rotors.
"Best of luck, mate. That's my cousin, Scheherazade Shang. She's working on her dissertation at the Sorbonne. Brains and beauty. You know, I've heard there's another dude that's been trying to get her number for years with absolutely no success. His name's Prince Harry." As the Shangs retreated into the house with the President of China, Rachel, Carlton, and Peck Lin followed a few paces behind. In the grand foyer, they ran into Oliver Sin, staring disapprovingly as hordes of people passed through, navigating past hundreds of floral wreaths, some bigger than Michelin tires, that now invaded the space.
"Rachel, wonderful to see you.
Isn't this awful?
Oliver whispered in her ear. Singaporeans just love sending these ghastly funeral wreaths.
Rachel glanced at the card and the nearest wreath.
Great Eastern Life Assurance offers condolences on the death of Madam Shang Su-yi.
As they continued past the dining room, where an enormous dinner buffet had been set up, Rachel could see guests standing in a long queue that snaked out the terrace doors, waiting to devour the delicacies at the various food stations. A little boy dashed past Rachel, shouting,
"Auntie Doreen wants more chili crab!"
"Whoa!" Rachel said, narrowly dodging the boy, who was precariously clutching a heaping platter of crustaceans.
"Not what you were expecting?" Pecklin said with a laugh.
"Not quite. It's all so
festive," Rachel remarked.
"It's the funeral of the year,"
Oliver quipped. "Don't you know everyone who's anyone wants to be here?"
A little earlier, a rather pushy young socialite named Serena Tang tried to take a selfie with Sui's coffin. She got thrown out, of course.
"Here, let's take a shortcut."
He directed them through a side door, and the atmosphere changed completely. They found themselves in the magnificent Andalusian cloister, an enclosed courtyard surrounded by carved columns open to the sky. Rows of chairs with white slipcases had been arranged around the reflecting pool in the center of the courtyard, and the guests who gathered here murmured quietly amid the sound of the trickling water. Antique silk lamps had been placed in each of the arched alcoves surrounding the courtyard, the flickering candles within each lamp adding to the monastic stillness of the space. At the far end of the courtyard, in front of the carved lotus blossom fountain, Sui's simple black teak wood casket rested on a marble dais surrounded by orchids. In a nearby alcove, Nick, his parents, and many members of the extended Yang clan stood in an informal receiving line. Nick was dressed in a white button-down shirt with black trousers, and Rachel noticed that all the men present, Nick's father, Alistair Ching, and a few other men she didn't recognize, were dressed in the same manner.
"Rachel, why don't you go to Nick first? We don't want to disrupt your reunion," Pecklin suggested.
Rachel nodded and descended the few steps into the courtyard toward the receiving line, feeling her stomach tense up in a sudden wave of anxiety. Nick was hugging Lucia Shang and was just about to be introduced to the President of China when he saw her approach. He quickly stepped out of the receiving line and dashed to her.
"Darling," he said, sweeping her into an embrace.
"Oh my, did you just diss the President of China?" Rachel asked.
"Did I? Oh well, who cares?
You're far more important."
Nick laughed and, taking Rachel by the hand, led her to the receiving line and announced proudly,
"Everyone, my wife has arrived."
Rachel immediately felt every eye in the room turn to take her in. Philip and Eleanor welcomed Rachel, and the avalanche of introductions began. Nick's uncles, aunts, and cousins from all the various branches greeted her far more warmly than she had expected, and suddenly, Rachel found herself face to face with the President of China. Before she could say anything, Nick stepped forward and announced in Mandarin,
"This is my wife. I believe her father, Bao Gaoliang, serves on your standing committee."
The president looked momentarily startled, and then he broke into a wide grin.
"Your Gaoliang's daughter? The economics professor from New York? It's a pleasure to meet you at last. My God, you look just like your brother Carlton."
"He's right over there,"
Rachel replied in perfect Mandarin, waving her brother over.
"Carlton Bao, you seem to be everywhere these days. Didn't I just see you at my daughter's birthday dinner 2 nights ago? I hope you're flying on air miles,"
the president said in mock seriousness.
"Of course, sir," Carlton replied. He beamed at the gathered group, making sure to catch Scheherazade's eye.
Alfred Chang, who had observed the whole scene silently, looked at Rachel and Carlton with a newfound curiosity.
Rachel turned to Nick and said in a quiet voice, "Can I pay my respects to your grandmother?" "Of course," he said. They walked up to the casket, which was surrounded by exquisite orchids in delicate celadon pots. "My grandmother was most proud of her prize-winning orchids. I don't think I ever saw her happier than the day the National Orchid Society named one of her hybrids after her." Rachel peered into the casket, a little hesitantly, but she was surprised by how splendid Su-yi looked. She lay majestically swathed in a robe of shimmering yellow silk, intricately embroidered with flowers, and her hair was crowned by the most spectacular Piranakan headpiece made of gold and pearls. Rachel bowed her head for a moment, and when she looked up at Nick, she saw that his eyes were brimming with tears. Placing her arm around his waist, she said, "I'm so glad you got to see her before she passed. She looks very peaceful."
"Yes, she does," Nick said, sniffing quietly.
Rachel noticed something glistening between Sui's teeth. What's that in her mouth?"
"It's a black pearl. It's an old Chinese custom. The pearl ensures a smooth transition into the afterlife," Nick explained. "And do you see the Fabergé case beside her?"
"Yeah." Rachel noticed a small rectangular bejeweled box next to the pillow.
"Those are her glasses, so she can have perfect vision in her next life."
Before Rachel could make another comment, a strange whimpering sound could be heard echoing from one of the alcoves. They turned to see Alistair and his father Malcolm holding up a frail man as he limped toward them slowly. Rachel realized with a start that the man was Nick's cousin Eddie, and behind him walked his wife Fiona, and their three children, all dressed in matching black linen and silk bespoke outfits.
"Kaiser Wilhelm has arrived," Oliver pronounced, rolling his eyes.
Eddie collapsed into a heap dramatically at the foot of the casket and began to convulse and emit deep, hacking sobs.
"Amma! Amma! What will I do without you now?"
he wailed, flailing his arms wildly, almost knocking over one of the orchid pots. Felicity Leong whispered to her sister Alex,
"He better not break any of those vases. They're worth a fortune."
"What a devoted grandson," the president of China observed.
Hearing this, Eddie cried out even more bitterly.
"How can I go on living, Amma? How will I survive?"
Tears poured down his face, mixing with lines of dangling snot as he continued to prostrate himself beside his grandmother's casket. Eddie's two younger children, Augustine and Calliste, knelt on either side of their father and began to rub his back soothingly. He elbowed the kids quickly, and they started to cry on cue. Standing at a distance, Alistair whispered to Pecklin,
"I guess we didn't need to hire any professional mourners."
"If you're looking to make some extra cash, many families in Singapore will hire you to cry at the funerals of their loved ones. Because the more mourners there are at a funeral, the more impressive it looks. Professional mourners usually come in groups, and they offer a variety of packages, i.e. normal crying, moaning hysterically, foaming at the mouth, and collapsing in front of the coffin."
"Well, your brother can certainly do this professionally. The kids are doing a great job, too. I'm sure they were forced to rehearse a million times," Alistair said.
Eddie suddenly turned around and glared at his other son.
"Constantine, my firstborn. Come, give your great-grandma a kiss."
"No fucking way, Dad. I don't care how much you say you pay me. I'm not going to kiss a dead body."
Eddie's nostrils flared in rage, but since everyone was staring at them, he simply gave his son a big, "You're gonna get your ass whooped later" smile and sprang up from the ground. He smoothed out his mandarin-collared linen suit and announced,
"Everyone, I have a surprise in honor of Amma. Please follow me."
He led the group of relatives out to the walled rose garden that bordered the east wing of the house.
Casper, we're ready,
he shouted. Suddenly, a bank of floodlights illuminated the darkened garden, and everyone gasped. In front of them was a three-story structure made out of wood and paper. It was an intricately constructed scale model of Tyersal Park, with every pillar, eave, and awning painstakingly replicated down to the last detail.
Casper von Morgenlatte, my personal decorator, had a whole team of artisans working on this for weeks,
Eddie proudly announced, bowing to the crowd that had by now gathered in front of the house replica.
I am not a decorator. I am an interior architect and an art consultant,
declared a tall, exceedingly thin man with slicked back white blonde hair, dressed in a white turtleneck sweater and high-waisted white linen trousers.
Ladies and gentlemen, please pay attention. The interior of this magnificent Schloss opens up.
Four equally blonde assistants scurried out from the shadows. They unfastened a few hinges along the side columns, allowing the entire front facade of the house to open and reveal interior rooms that had been decorated to excruciating detail, but unfortunately did not replicate the real interiors of Tyersal Park.
The walls are 24-carat gold leaf. The fabrics are all pierre-frais. The crystal chandeliers are Swarovski, and the finishings are handcrafted by the same people that did the set designs for Wes Anderson's Grand Hotel Budapest,
Casper continued.
Good God, what an insult to Wes. This looks more like a Ukrainian bordello,
Oliver whispered to Rachel.
Thank God it's about to be set on fire.
Rachel laughed. I know you don't care for it, but don't you think that's a bit extreme?
Rachel, Oliver's not joking, Nick cut in. This is a paper tomb offering. People burn these at funerals as gifts for the deceased to enjoy in the afterlife. It's an ancient ritual.
It's more of a working-class custom, Oliver continued.
The families buy paper objects and accessories that represent aspirational things the deceased couldn't afford in this life. Paper mansions, Ferraris, iPads, Gucci bags.
In 2016, Gucci sent out warning letters about trademark infringement to several mom-and-pop shops in Hong Kong that were selling paper Gucci tomb offerings. After a backlash from Chinese shoppers and an avalanche of bad publicity, Gucci issued an apology.
But the paper mansions are usually quite small, like dollhouses.
Eddie, of course, has to do everything to the extreme, Oliver noted as Eddie walked around the three-story house, excitedly showing off all the objects he had commissioned.
Check out her closet. I had some little dresses made in her favorite lotus silk.
And I even had them make exact replicas of Hermes Birkin bags, so Ama will have a good selection of handbags to use in heaven.
The family members stared at the structure in stunned silence. Finally, Eddie's mother said,
Mummy would never use an Hermes handbag. She never carried a handbag. Her lady's maids held everything for her.
Eddie glared at his mother angrily.
Ugh. You just don't get it, do you? I know she wouldn't normally carry an Hermes. I'm just trying to give Ama the best of everything. That's all.
It's very impressive, Eddie. Mummy would have been touched, Catherine said, trying to be diplomatic.
Victoria suddenly piped up.
No, no. This is all wrong. It's incredibly tasteless. And what's more, it's extremely unchristian. Auntie Victoria, this is a Chinese tradition. It has nothing to do with religion,
Eddie argued. Victoria shook her head in fury.
I don't want to hear any more of this nonsense. We Christians do not require worldly things in the kingdom of heaven. Remove this monstrosity at once.
Do you know how much I spent on this mansion? This cost me over $250,000. We are burning it, and we are burning it now.
Eddie shouted back as he gave Casper the signal.
Wolfgang, Jürgen, Helmut, Schatzi, and Zundit, das Feuer,
Casper commanded. The Aryan minions dashed around the structure, dousing it with kerosene, and Eddie theatrically flicked a long matchstick and held it high for all to see.
Don't you dare! Don't you dare burn it on this property! It's satanic, I tell you!
Victoria screamed as she ran up to Eddie and began trying to wrestle the burning matchstick out of his hand. Eddie lopped the match onto the structure and it ignited instantly, the force of the flames billowing outward suddenly and almost singeing both their heads. As the enormous replica of Tyersal Park began to be consumed by the fire, all the guests streamed out of the house and surrounded it like a bonfire, taking out their phones and snapping photos. Eddie stared in triumphant silence at the burning house, while Victoria sobbed on the shoulder of the President of China. Cassian, Jake, Augustine, and Callist ran around the structure gleefully.
"It's actually rather beautiful, isn't it?" Rachel said as Nick came up behind her, wrapping her in his arms as they stared at the fire together.
"It is. I have to agree with Eddie this time. I think Ama would have enjoyed this. And why shouldn't she have a Birkin bag in heaven?"
Carlton glanced at Scheherazade, marveling at how her hair seemed to glow the most spectacular shades of gold against the rising flames. He took a deep breath, straightened his jacket, and strode over to where she was standing.
"Je m'appelle Carlton. Je suis le frère de Rachel. Ça va?"
"Ça va bien,"
Scheherazade replied, impressed by his perfect French accent. Breaking into English, Carlton said, "They don't have anything quite like this in Paris, do they?"
"No, they sure don't,"
she answered with a smile. As the paper house and all the paper luxury accoutrements smoldered into black ashes, the crowd began to make their way back into the house. Walking through the rose garden, Mrs. Li Yongchen shook her head and leaned over to Lillian Mei Tan's ear.
"What did I tell you? Sui's body isn't even cold yet, and the family is already up in smoke. This is nothing. Things are going to get far worse when they find out who will get the house,"
Lillian Mei said, her eyes flashing in anticipation.
"I think they are in for the shock of their lives," Mrs. Li whispered back.
A humongous full-page color notice appeared in the obituary section of the Straits Times for 5 consecutive days.
"The chairman, board of directors, and employees of the Lichtenberg Group, AG, offer our deepest sympathies to our esteemed and highly valued partner, Edison Ching, Senior Executive Vice Chairman, Private Banking, Global, on the passing of his beloved grandmother, Shang Su-yi. Parting is such sweet sorrow. William Shakespeare." For inquiries on superlative wealth management, visit www.lichtenberg.com/myoffshorecapital/Edison Ching. Chapter 3. The Claymore, Singapore. Oliver Sen was in the middle of his morning shave in his condo when Kitty rang, so he put her on speaker.
"I'm going to see you today. I'm going to Alistair Ching's grandmother's funeral this afternoon," Kitty chirped.
"You received an invitation?" Oliver tried to mask the astonishment in his voice.
"I thought since Alistair is my ex-boyfriend, and I did meet his grandmother once, it would only be appropriate to convey my condolences in person. It will be so nice to see his family again."
"Where did you even hear about the funeral?" Oliver asked, as he arched his neck toward the mirror and focused his razor on the stray hairs under his chin.
"Everyone was talking about it at Wandi Megahato Wijawa's party last night. Apparently, Wandi knows a few of the people from Jakarta flying in for the funeral. She said it was going to be the society funeral of the century."
"I bet she did. But I'm afraid the funeral is really by invitation only."
"Well, you'll be able to get me an invitation, won't you?"
Implicit in Kitty's coquettish tone was, "since you're on my payroll." Oliver rinsed off his shaving cream. "Kitty, I'm afraid that this is one time where I really don't have the power to help you."
"What if I get dressed up in a very conservative black Roland Mouret dress and wear a nice hat? I'll even use the Bentley instead of the Rolls, and bring a few bodyguards along. Surely they won't turn me away.
Kitty, you need to trust me on this. This is one funeral you don't want to crash. It would be a faux pas of epic proportions. This is a funeral for family and very close friends only. I assure you there will be no one you know, and it really won't matter if you're not there.
Can you assure me that Colette won't be there?
Kitty, I can assure you she has probably never even heard of my family.
But that doesn't necessarily mean she won't be there. I heard she got back to Singapore 2 days ago. It was mentioned in Honey Chai's gossip blog. Countess of Palliser is staying at the Raffles Hotel. Did she leave her orangutans to come to the funeral?
Oliver rolled his eyes in exasperation. There is no way Colette, or Lady Mary, or whatever she calls herself these days, will be anywhere near that funeral. I promise.
I guess I'll go spend the day on Tatiana Savarin's new yacht, then. She says it was designed by the same guy that did Giorgio Armani's boat.
Yes, it's a beautiful day for sailing. Why don't you slip on your sexiest Erez bikini? Put on your sailing diamonds and spend the day sipping Aperol spritzes on a yacht. Stop wasting your precious time thinking about this dreary funeral that I wish I didn't have to attend.
Oliver lied. As much as he adored Sui, he had to admit that today was truly going to be the social event of the century.
Okay, okay.
Kitty laughed and hung up. Oliver leaned against his bathroom sink, methodically patting some florist aftershave on his cheeks and throat. The phone rang again.
Hello, Kitty.
What are sailing diamonds? Do I need to get some?
It's just an expression, Kitty. I made it up.
But do you think I should wear a diamond necklace with my bikini? I could put on my Chanel Joliet diamonds.
The one in the sunburst floral pattern. Diamonds are waterproof, aren't they?
Of course. Go for it.
I have to run now, Kitty, or I'm going to be late for the funeral.
2 seconds after hanging up, Oliver's mother, Bernadette, walked into the bathroom.
Mother, I'm not dressed.
Oliver groaned, tightening the towel around his waist.
Hiya! What do you have that I haven't already seen? Tell me, is this okay?
Oliver scrutinized his 69-year-old mother, slightly annoyed by the graying roots that were showing on the top of her head. Her Beijing hairdresser really wasn't doing a good job maintaining her color. Bernadette, who was born a Ling, came from a family where all the women were renowned for their beauty. Unlike her sisters or her cousins, Jacqueline Ling being the prime example who appeared preternaturally preserved, Bernadette looked her age. Actually, in the tailored dark blue silk brocade suit with the ribbon tie at the collar, she looked older.
This is what happens when you spend 25 years toiling away in China, Oliver thought to himself.
Is this the only dark dress you brought with you?
No, I brought 3 dresses, but I already wore the other 2 during the night visits.
Then I suppose this one will have to do. Did your tailor in Beijing make this one for you?
This one was very pricey compared to my Beijing tailor. Mabel Shang's girl in Singapore made this for me more than 30 years ago. It's a copy of some famous Paris designer, Pierre Cardin, I think.
Oliver exploded in laughter.
Mother, no one would copy a Pierre Cardin. It's probably one of those 1980s designers Mabel used to love.
Cherer, Faro, or Lanvin, back when Mariel was in charge.
Well, at least you can say it still fits.
You didn't bring one of your little cloche hats, did you?
No, I didn't. I packed for Singapore weather. But Oliver, what do you think of this?
Bernadette asked, fingering the impressive jade and ruby butterfly brooch pinned to her lapel.
Oh, it's fabulous.
You sure no one will be able to tell?
Heaven forbid I get seated next to your grandmother and she notices.
Bernadette fretted. With Grandma's glaucoma, I don't think she can even see that you have the brooch on.
Trust me, I had the best jeweler I know in London replicate it.
I should never have let the real thing go.
Bernadette sighed.
We didn't really have a choice, did we?
Just forget it ever happened.
You still have the brooch right here. The jade looks flawless. The rubies look real. The diamonds are sparkling like they came straight out of Lawrence Graff's hands. If I can't tell, no one will be able to tell.
If you say so. Now, do you have a tie Dad can borrow? The only one he brought got all stained with chocolate cake last night. So sad. Once Tyersall Park goes, I'm going to miss that chocolate cake.
Of course. Go to my closet and pick out anything you'd like for him. One of the Borellis might be nice. Actually, give me a second and I'll do it. As his mother left the bathroom, Oliver thought to himself, I've learned my lesson. Next time I'm going to put them up at a hotel, even if they kick and scream. Asian parents visiting their adult children who live in other cities always insist on staying with them, no matter if the child lives in a studio apartment or the house is already bursting at the seams with too many hormonal teenagers. And even if the parents could afford to buy out a whole floor of the Ritz-Carlton. And of course, if you're 46 years old, suffering from sleep apnea and chronic sciatica, you're still expected to give up your master bedroom to your parents and sleep on the inflatable mattress in the living room. Because that's just how it is. This flat is just too small for three people. Chapter 4. St. Andrew's Cathedral, Singapore. Inside the lead Mercedes, escorting the funeral cortege from Tyersall Park to the cathedral, Harry Leong was staring out the window trying to ignore the incessant chatter that came from his wife Felicity, arguing over last-minute details with her sister Victoria.
No, we have to let the President of Singapore speak first. That follows official protocol, Victoria said. But then the Sultan of Borneo will be terribly insulted. Royalty should always come before elected officials, Felicity argued back. Rubbish! This is our country, and our president has precedence. You only care about the Sultan because of all the Leong plantations in Borneo. I care about him not urinating all over the pulpit at St. Andrew's. His Majesty is an elderly diabetic with a weak bladder. He should get to have the first word. Besides, he knew Mummy even before the president was born. Reverend Bo Law Yong is going to have the first word. He's going to read the blessing. What? You invited Bo Law Yong too? How many pastors are going to be at this funeral? Felicity asked incredulously. Only three. Reverend Bo will deliver the blessing. Bishop Si will give the sermon. And Pastor Tony Chi will say the closing prayer. What a pity. Is it too late to ask Tony to deliver the sermon? He's so much better than that Si Bei Sien, Felicity scoffed. Harry Leong groaned. Can you speak softer? You two are giving me a migraine. If I knew you were going to argue all the way, I would have ridden in Astrid's car. You know your security won't let you ride with her. She doesn't have bulletproof windows, Felicity said. In the Jaguar XJL, which was not bulletproof, following behind them, Eleanor Young sat scrutinizing her son's face intently. I think next week I should make an appointment for you to see my dermatologist. Those puffy lines under your eyes, I'm not happy with them. Dr. Teo can do wonders with his laser. Mum, it's fine. I just didn't get much sleep last night, Nick said. He was up all night writing his tribute to Amma, Rachel explained. Why did it take all night? Eleanor asked. It was the hardest thing I've ever had to write, Mom. You try condensing Amar's entire life into 1,000 words. Rachel squeezed Nick's hand encouragingly. She knew how much he had struggled over his speech, working on it until the wee hours and getting out of bed several times after that to make a change or add another anecdote. Eleanor kept prodding. Why should there be a word limit? Auntie Victoria insisted that I only have 5 minutes for my speech, and that's about 1,000 words. 5 minutes? What nonsense!
You were her closest grandson and the only young. You should be allowed to speak as long as you wish. Apparently, there are going to be a lot of speeches, so I'm just towing the party line, Nick said. It's fine, Mum. I'm very happy with my speech now.
Oh, my. Who is that woman in the car beside us? Rachel suddenly asked.
Everyone turned to look into the Rolls that was trying to overtake them, where there was a woman wearing a black hat with a dramatic black veil draped over her face.
Looks like Marlena Dietrich.
Philip chuckled as he drove.
Aya, Philip, pay attention to the road,
Eleanor yelled.
Actually, it does look like Marlena Dietrich. I wonder which Sultan's wife that could be.
Peering over, Nick laughed. That's no Sultana. That's Fiona Tung behind that get-up. In the back seat of the Rolls-Royce Phantom, the only Rolls in the stately procession of cars, Fiona fidgeted with her hat uncomfortably.
I don't know why you made me wear this ridiculous veil. I can't see out of it, and I can hardly breathe.
Eddie snorted. I don't know what you're talking about. Callis can breathe just fine in hers. Can't you? Eddie's tween daughter was wearing a hat and veil identical to her mother's, and she stared straight ahead, not answering her father.
Callist, I said, can you breathe?
She's got headphones on, Dad. She can't see or hear a thing. She's like Helen Keller right now,
Augustine said.
At least Helen Keller could speak,
Eddie said in annoyance. Actually, she couldn't, Pa. She was mute. Constantine responded from the front passenger seat. Eddie reached over and tucked his daughter's veil aside.
Get those headphones off! Don't you dare wear them into the church! What difference does it make? No one will be able to see me under this thing. Can't I just listen to Shawn Mendes while I'm in the church? I promise you, his songs will make me cry buckets like you want me to.
No Shawn Mendes. And no Mario Lopez, Rosie Perez, or Lola Montez either.
Kids, you are all going to sit in the church with ramrod straight posture, singing all the hymns and crying pitifully. Cry as if I've cut off your allowance.
That's really going to work, Dad. Boo-hoo-hoo. What am I going to do without my $20 this week?
Constantine said sarcastically.
Okay. You've just lost your allowance for the rest of the year.
And if I don't see you crying until your eyes bleed, especially while I'm singing my song...
Eddie, enough.
What is the point of trying to force the kids to cry when they don't wish to cry? Fiona snapped.
How many times do I have to tell you? We need to be the chief mourners at this funeral. We need to show everyone how much we care. Because all eyes will be on us. Everyone knows that we are going to be benefiting the most.
And how would they know that?
Fiona, have you been in dreamland all week? Ama died before she could make any changes to her will. We're going to be the ones getting the lion's share. In a few days, we're going to become bona fide members of the Three Comma Club.
Just count the commas and you'll understand what Eddie means. $1 billion.
So we have to really go out to display our grief.
Fiona shook her head in disgust. At this moment, her husband truly made her feel like crying.
Lorena! Lorena, over here! I chopped this seat for you!
A Singlish term meaning to reserve. Singaporeans chop seats at concerts, hawker centers, and other public venues by placing a packet of tissue paper on the seat.
Daisy shouted, waving from her strategically chosen aisle seat. Lorena made a beeline for Daisy and saw the packet of tissues she had placed next to her on the wooden pew.
Thanks for saving me this seat. I thought I was going to have to sit with my in-laws. Is Cutie still parking?
Aya, you know my husband doesn't do funerals. Just the sight of a coffin will give him diarrhea.
Just then, there was a loud buzzing from Daisy's handbag.
Wait, I'm going to take out my iPad. Nadine wanted me to FaceTime her from the funeral.
She's beside herself that she didn't get invited.
What? Ronnie and her didn't get invitations?
No. Old man Shaw got the invitation, and of course he brought the new wife.
They are two rows in front of us.
Lorena craned her neck to look at Nadine's father-in-law, the 85-year-old stroke survivor, Sir Ronald Shaw, and his brand-new 29-year-old wife from Shenzhen.
I must say, she's very pretty. But I'm still surprised that Sir Ronald isn't, you know, Chi Chong Fan.
Aiya, these days with Viagra,
even Chi Chong Fan can become Yu Zha Gui.
Chi Chong Fan, a long, limp rice noodle roll.
Yu Zha Gui,
a long, stiff, deep-fried breadstick. Daisy giggled as she activated the FaceTime function. Nadine's dramatically made-up face popped up on screen.
Alamak, Daisy.
I've been waiting and waiting. Who's arrived? Who do you see?
Well, your father-in-law is here with your new, mother-in-law.
Oh, who gives a damn about them? How does Eleanor look? And what's Astrid wearing?
Nadine asked.
Eleanor, of course, looks great. I think she's wearing that black acre suit with notched lapels she bought when we all went to the Harrods sale a couple of years ago. Astrid hasn't arrived yet, or at least I don't see her anywhere. Oh my goodness, who's this? The bride of Frankenstein just walked in.
What? Who? Hold up your iPad, let me see,
Nadine said excitedly. Daisy covertly pointed her iPad toward the central aisle.
Alama, it's Eddie Ching's wife, the long-suffering Tong girl. She's dressed up like Queen Victoria in full mourning garb, with a big black hat covered by a floor-length black veil. And oh look, their daughter is dressed just like her.
And the sons are wearing black brocade Nehru jackets. Good grief, they look like they're in some suicide cult. Rachel went along with Nick's parents to the beautifully polished wooden pews reserved for the family, marveling at the beautiful neo-Gothic features of Singapore's oldest cathedral as she walked up the central aisle. Nick, meanwhile, headed to the chapel behind the altar to confer with his Aunt Victoria, who was in the midst of coordinating all the speakers. He shook the president's hand and waited patiently for his marching orders. Victoria finally noticed him.
Oh, Nicky, good, you're here. Listen, I hope you don't mind, but we've had to cut your speech from the program. We simply don't have the time with everyone needing to speak.
Nick stared at her in dismay. You're not serious.
I'm afraid I am.
Please understand. We're already running over time. We have three pastors speaking, the Sultan of Borneo, and the President, and then the Thai ambassador has a special message to deliver, and we also have to fit in Eddie's song.
Eddie's going to sing?
Nick was incredulous.
Oh, yes. He's been rehearsing a special hymn all week with a very special guest musician who's just flown in.
So let me understand this. We have six people giving speeches, but no one from the family will actually get a chance to speak about Ama.
Well, there's also been a last-minute addition. Henry Leong Jr. has decided to give a speech.
Henry Jr.?
But he barely knows Ama. He spent most of his life in Malaysia being doted on by his Leong grandparents.
Victoria smiled embarrassedly at the president, who was watching the whole exchange with piqued interest.
Nicky, may I remind you that your cousin Henry is the eldest grandson. He has every right to give a speech. And besides,
Victoria lowered her voice. He's running for a seat in Parliament this year. Felicity said we have to let him speak. And of course the president wants him to.
Nick stared at his aunt for a moment. Without another word, he turned around and headed back to his pew. Michael Teo, Astrid's estranged husband, came striding up the central aisle of St. Andrew's Cathedral dressed in a brand-new Rubenacci suit with shiny black John Lop wingtips. He looked around for where Leong family members might be seated, and just as he caught sight of Astrid fussing over Cassian's Windsor knot in the second pew from the front,
Two men in dark suits suddenly appeared, blocking his path.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Teo. Family only on this side," the man with the earpiece said.
Michael opened his mouth, about to say something, but as he knew that all eyes were on him, he nodded, smiled politely, and took the nearest empty seat in another pew. Sitting in the pew opposite from Michael were members of the Sien family.
"Did you see that? That was brutal," Oliver whispered to his Aunt Nancy.
"Huh! Serves him right. I don't know how he even got an invitation."
Nancy huffed as she thought to herself.
"That man was wasted on Astrid. The things I could do with that body."
Nancy turned to face Oliver's mother.
"Bernadette, how nice you look in that frock."
"Ghastly. I can smell the mothballs."
"Thank you. You look so fashionable as always," Bernadette replied, eyeing Nancy's Gautier couture dress. "Wasting my brother-in-law's money. No matter how expensive that dress is, you still look like mutton dressed as lamb."
"It's always nice to see the Sien jade come out for an airing."
Nancy eyed the brooch Bernadette had on.
"This should have been mine. What a travesty to see it pinned on that horrific schmata she calls a dress."
The heirloom jewel had been passed down from Sien Sai Tae's mother to Bernadette, her favorite granddaughter-in-law, and was said to have belonged to the Empress Dowager Sian. Nancy leaned over and said to her mother-in-law,
"Do you see Bernadette's brooch? Doesn't the carved jade butterfly look more translucent and vibrant than ever?"
Rosemary smiled.
"It's imperial jade. It always looks better the more it's worn. I'm so glad we gave it to Bernadette. This is the gift that keeps on giving. Just seeing how jealous Nancy still is after all these years."
Bernadette smiled nervously at the two women and tried desperately to deflect attention from herself.
Nancy, this is nothing. I don't have much compared to you. Look at your pearls. My goodness, I've never seen so many worn at the same time."
"She looks like a mad woman who just robbed Mikimoto."
Nancy fingered the enormous Sri Lankan sapphire and diamond clasp on her 8-strand pearl necklace.
"Oh, these? I've had them for ages. I think Dickie bought these for me when we were invited to Prince Abdullah of Jordan's wedding to the beautiful Rania. Of course, this was long before he knew he was going to be king."
Overhearing the exchange, Oliver added,
"I don't think Abdullah ever expected it. His uncle was supposed to be the next king, but Hussein bypassed him on his deathbed and anointed his son the successor. It was a shock to everyone."
Nancy sat back in her seat, wondering what shocks lay in store for her young relatives. What would become of all of Sui's jewelry? Her collection was said to be unparalleled in all of Asia, so there was surely going to be a battle royal over her treasures. Sitting in the middle of a row, Astrid heard an urgent little ping from her cell phone. She got out her phone discreetly and read the text message. "Michael Teo, first you exclude my name from the Straits Times death notice, and now you bar me from sitting next to my own son? You're gonna pay for this." Astrid began texting back furiously.
"Astrid Leong, what are you talking about? My mother and uncle arranged the notice. I didn't even know you were coming."
"MT, I'm not a monster. I liked your ama, okay?"
AL,
"So where are you now? You're going to be late."
MT, "Already here. I'm sitting one row behind and across from you."
Astrid swiveled around and saw Michael seated across the aisle.
AL,
"Why are you over there?"
MT, "Don't pretend you don't know. Your father's fucking bodyguards wouldn't let me into your row."
AL, "I promise you I had nothing to do with that. Come join us now."
Michael stood up, but before he could leave his pew, a cluster of guests walking up the aisle blocked him from moving. Instead, they were being directed into his row,
and a lady wearing a chic dark gray silk chantant dress with a silver gray frayed boucle topper coat and black gloves was ushered into the seat next to him. Astrid's jaw dropped. She spun around and faced Oliver, who was seated just behind her. Am I hallucinating? Or is that who I think it is over there in head-to-toe Chanel couture? Oliver turned and saw the lady who had just taken the seat on the aisle opposite from him.
Holy Anita Sarawak, he muttered under his breath.
It was Colette, sitting with her husband, the Earl of Palliser, and the British ambassador.
How stupid of him.
Of course the Earl would attend. His father, the Duke of Glencora, was great friends with Alfred Chang. Eagle-eyed Nancy Sien leaned over and whispered to Oliver.
Who is that girl over there?
Which girl? Oliver asked, feigning ignorance.
The pretty Chinese girl sitting with all those Angmos.
As the two of them looked at Colette, she suddenly swept her hair aside, revealing an enormous jade butterfly brooch pinned to her left shoulder. Oliver turned white as a sheet. Nancy almost gasped, but she stopped herself. Instead, she said,
What an exquisite brooch. Mummy, do you see that lady's lovely jade brooch?
She tucked furiously at Rosemary Sien's elbow.
Oh, yes.
Rosemary paused for a moment in recognition.
How lovely it is.
Just then, Reverend Bo Law Yong approached the pulpit and spoke too close to the microphone. His voice came out booming.
Your Majesties, Highnesses, Excellencies, Mr. President, Ladies and Gentlemen, may I present Shang Sui's dearest grandson, Edison Cheng, accompanied by the one and only Lang Lang.
The crowd murmured excitedly at the announcement of the celebrated pianist, and all eyes were on the main altar as Lang Lang walked to the grand piano and began to play the opening chords of a curiously familiar melody. The doors of the cathedral swung open, and 8 Gurkha guards from Tyersal Park stood silhouetted in the dramatic arched entrance, bearing Sui's casket on their shoulders. Captain Vikram Gale was the lead pallbearer, and as they slowly began to enter the nave of the cathedral, Eddie emerged from the shadows of the transept and took his place in front of the piano, a lone spotlight on him. As the guests in the church stood up respectfully, the casket made its way up the central aisle as Eddie began to sing in a quivering tenor.
It must have been cold there in my shadow to never have sunlight on your face.
You've got to be fucking kidding me, Nick muttered, burying his face in his hands. They cut your speech for this?
Rachel was furious and yet trying desperately not to laugh.
Did I ever tell you you're my hero?
Eddie belted out, not quite hitting the right pitch. Victoria turned to Felicity with a frown.
What on earth?
Felicity whispered to Astrid. Do you know this hymn?
It's not a hymn, Mum.
It's Wind Beneath My Wings by Bette Midler.
Bette who?
Exactly. She's a singer Ama would never have heard of either. As the guards proceeded up the aisle, everyone in the cathedral suddenly went quiet as they caught sight of Sui's 2 devoted Thai ladies' maids. Swathed in dark gray silk dresses with a single black orchid pinned above their breasts, they walked 5 paces behind her casket, tears running down their faces. Chapter 5 St. Andrew's Cathedral, Singapore. After the memorial service, guests were invited to a white tent that had been erected next to the cathedral, where everyone could mingle over an elaborate afternoon tea buffet. The tent was decorated to replicate Sui's conservatory at Tyersal Park. Hundreds of pots of orchids in full bloom hung from the ceiling, while towering topiaries composed of roses from Sui's rose garden commanded each of the tables covered in Battenberg lace. A battalion of waitstaff rolled around antique silver carts arrayed with steaming cups of Darjeeling tea and ice-cold flutes of Lillet champagne, while chefs in white toques manned the tables filled with afternoon tea standards like finger sandwiches, scones with clotted cream, and Nonya cakes. Nick, Rachel, and Astrid sat in a quiet corner reminiscing with cousins Alistair, Scheherazade, and Lucia. "You know, I used to be deathly afraid of Ama when I was little," Alistair confessed. "I think it's because all the adults seem to fear her. I just picked up on that."
"Really? She always seemed like a fairy godmother to me," Scheherazade said. "I remember one summer holes many years ago. I was wandering around Tyasal Park by myself when I came upon great Auntie Sui. She was standing at the edge of that pond with those enormous lily pads, and when she saw me, she said, 'Ziyi, come.' She always called me by my Chinese name. She looked up at the sky and made this clicking sound with her tongue. Out of nowhere, these two swans swooped down and landed right on the pond. Sui reached into the pocket of that blue gardening coat she always wore and pulled out little sardines. The swans glided up to her and gently ate the sardines out of her hand. I was absolutely mesmerized."
"Yes, those swans were the same pair that were always at the lake in the botanic gardens. Ama used to say, 'Everyone thinks these swans live there, but actually this is their pond, and they just visit the botanic gardens because they've gotten fat and spoiled by all the tourists that feed them.'" Nick remembered.
"It's not fair. I feel like you got to know great Auntie Sui much better than I did, Scheherazade,"
Lucia said with a little pout. Rachel shot Lucia a smile and then noticed Carlton strolling nonchalantly toward them.
"Carlton, how did you get through Fort Knox?"
"I may or may not have been slipped an invitation by someone," Carlton said with a wink, as Scheherazade blushed.
"Astrid,
mind if I have a quick word?" Carlton said.
"Me?"
Astrid looked up in surprise.
"Yes."
Astrid got up from her chair, and Carlton took her over to a corner. "I have a message from a friend. Go to the chapel behind the north transept of the cathedral right now. Trust me."
"Oh, okay,"
Astrid said, her brow furrowed at Carlton's mysterious message. She walked out of the tent and headed into the church through a side door, making her way to the north transept. As she entered the small alcove chapel within the cathedral, her eyes took a moment to adjust to the darkened room. A figure emerged from behind a pillar.
"Charlie! Oh my God! What are you doing here?"
Astrid exclaimed as she rushed to embrace him. "I just couldn't let you be alone today." Charlie hugged her tight, kissing her forehead repeatedly. "How are you?"
"I'm okay, I guess."
"I know this is the last thing on your mind, but you look stunning today," Charlie said, marveling at her knee-length black dress with a white Greek key motif piping on the skirt and collar.
"This was my grandmother's, from the 1930s.
"Was the service beautiful?"
"I wouldn't really call it that. It was grand, and it was strange. The Sultan of Borneo talked about the war and how my great-grandfather helped to save his family. He spoke in Malay, so everything had to be translated by this very perky woman. Then my brother spoke. And he was so weird and stilted, he sounded like the Manchurian candidate. The most emotional moment came when my grandmother's casket first entered the church. When I saw Madri and Patravadi walking behind the casket, I just lost it. I know it's been a very sad day. I brought something for you. I was debating at first whether or not to show it to you today, but I think it might actually cheer you up." Charlie took a small envelope out of his pocket and handed it to Astrid. She opened it up and unfolded a handwritten note.
"Dear Astrid, I hope you don't mind the intrusion, but I wanted to explain how sorry I am to hear of your grandmother's passing. She was a great lady, and I know she meant so much to you. I was very close to my Ama as well, so I can imagine what you must be feeling right now. I also want to apologize for my actions several months ago in Singapore. I am so terribly sorry for any pain or embarrassment I might have caused to you and your family. As I'm sure you're aware, I was not myself that day. I have made a complete recovery since then,
and I can only hope and pray that you will accept my heartfelt apology now. In the last few months, I've had the luxury of time. Time to heal and recover. Time to reassess my life. I know now that I do not ever wish to come between what you and Charlie have together. And I